Discussion of what I've called family in crisis. The encounter between leading to the reconciliation, but this is the encounter between Yosef and his brothers in Egypt. Okay, so last week we discussed the response of the family, everything they went through until they arrived at the decision. Yaakov finally arrived at the decision that they would have to return, and he formulated a plan. So now we're going to take up the next phase of the story, and that is the return to Egypt. And I asked you to go through the story, and again, if you go through it slowly and carefully, you'll see that there's a lot of questions. It's not as simple as would appear at first sight. Let's just quickly go through the basics of the story. And then we'll raise the problems, and hopefully we'll of course try and resolve them. So what happens? They return. It begins at Tesvav. This is 43:15. The men took the gift, this gift, and the double amount of money they took in their hands, and Benjamin, and they got up and they returned to Egypt. And they stood before Yosef. So now they've returned. Then it says, Yosef saw that Binyamin was with them, and he gives his instructions. He told the one who was in command over his house. The Mepharshim says that was his son, Menashe. But really, it doesn't make that much difference as far as we're concerned. So he gives instructions to bring them to his house and to prepare food. Prepare a meal for them, because they're going to eat with me at the afternoon. Okay, so the man did that, and he brought the people to the house of Yosef. So what's their reaction? It says, "Vayiru hanashim," that's with two yuds. They were afraid. So this produces a fear in them. They were frightened that they were brought to the house of Yosef. And they said it's because of the money. The money which has been returned in our sacks at the beginning, because of that we're being brought back. To frame us? At this point in time, it seems like their worst fears are being realized. This is what we were afraid of, to frame us and to fall upon us. We're victims now of this entrapment, and to take us and our servants and our donkeys, which is just the wording itself there strikes me as being strange. What strikes you as being strange? This is sort of an aside. Yes, what's strange about this pasuk, Natasha? The donkeys. Why is that strange? The statement is strange because who's worried? I mean, the real, you assume that, put yourself in that situation. So here they're concerned that they're involved in this tremendous calamity. They're going to be destroyed. They're facing a total destruction, which is, so he's going to take us, and he's going to, who knows what he's going to do to us. So who cares about the donkeys? I mean, that's not the the problem. Yeah, to take us and our servants. Even the mention of the servants is not... They were so concerned, so you'll say, well, they were concerned about the fate of their servants too, that you could sort of justify. But the donkeys, I mean, that's irrelevant. I mean, why is that a problem? You're not going to need, if you're going to be incarcerated or you're going to be destroyed, you're not going to need your donkeys. That's what you're worried about. You're worried about your donkeys? Yeah. It's it's a fabrication, it's a plot, you know, that type of thing. So maybe they're using different terms. I'm not saying you can't ask that question, but it's not a problem. But but why would you mention in such a context that he intends to take our animals as well? That seems like that's what they're worried about. You're worried about a major. You're worried about something really major, right? The whole your whole family could be wiped out, and so on and so forth. And in addition, you know, he'll take your canary. I mean, like it's it's not the way a person thinks at a time like that. Okay, right now. It looks terrible to them. This is the worst case scenario. So they approached a man who was in the control of the house of Yosef, and they spoke to him at the door to the house. Bear in mind that at this point in time, they're not in the inner chambers of the house. Now, that's something that emerges, because afterwards they enter into the house. So at this point in time, they're on the... No, that doesn't matter. But they're at the entranceway of the house. You see, one thing that they had no idea where they were going. That's an interesting kind of thing. Yosef instructed his assistant to bring them to his house. So when they, I assume they got on their animals, however they traveled to his house from the border point, they had no idea where they were being taken. You see? So that's why it was when they realized, when they saw, when they were afraid, when they realized that they were in the house of Yosef, then they became afraid. So apparently there was a reason for that too. That he, that's why this discussion takes place at the door. As soon as they saw that they're being brought to the house of Yosef, then they got frightened. Why is he taking us to his house? Oh, this is because he wants to fabricate a plot against us. So that's why it was before they entered the house. Now, so they immediately go to the his assistant, and they of course assume it's because of the money. And they plead with him. They say, "Please, my master, we came down at the beginning to purchase food." And they try and explain what happened with the money. "We came to the lodging. We opened up our sacks." Of course, they change the story a little bit. "And behold, each man's money was in a sack. Our money, according to the exact amount that we had laid out for the food. And we brought it back in our hands." What's that? Well, no, apparently he was somebody... No, that makes sense. Apparently he was somebody who was in command, who had some influence. So they wanted to make it clear that they came back with the money. If that's the issue, the only thing they could think of course, would be the money. They brought Binyamin back. So the only thing would be the issue of the money. So it's obvious this person is not just a taxi driver, he has some influence. So, no, that made sense to try and at least explain the situation to him, make it clear that we brought back the money. Of course, you don't know, it could be over the money, it could be a misunderstanding as well. I mean, they're trying to get some kind of an edge before Yosef comes. I think that makes sense. And they said, "And other monies we brought down in our hands to purchase food. We do not know who placed the money in our sacks." They have no choice. And the only thing they change, which I can understand, doesn't make sense to say one person found it on the road, the rest of us found it later. That's absurd. Well, why go into that? It makes more sense. Keep it smooth. And fine. Now, let's take a look at the answer. And you tell me what's problematical about this. Here's where I think we encounter one of our first major, major problems. So, here they are in a situation expecting the worst, and then suddenly things take a marked improvement for the better. And the man says, "Peace be unto you. Don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your fathers has given you a treasure in your sacks, a matmon, a little hidden treasure. Your money has come to me. I've received your money." And the man brought them out Shimon. So this has to be something which was amazing. Here they're expecting the worst, and they think it's all about the money, and you couldn't have asked for a better response. What's strange though about the answer? Assuming that that fits in with Chazal, this is Menashe, that the individual in charge of Joseph's house is Menashe, his own son, which makes sense that he trusted him. He was acting together with Yosef. Everything he did was at the instructions of Yosef. So I don't think he just decided to answer this way on his own. This answer was planned. Yosef knew, of course, that the issue of the money would come up. What is strange about the answer? One thing is like this.
He could have said, "I don't want the money."
If it's part of Yosef's plan is to cause them to lose their fears about the money. They should be relaxed about the money. Right? a misunderstanding. That's the ulai mishtu. It's always possible it's a misunderstanding. So he would have said, all right, a mistake was made, and then he would have had the option. Okay, it's a mistake. We accept your. You brought it back in your hand. Everything is fine. So either we could take the money back.
Or you could keep it.
But that's one option. We could take the money back. But don't be afraid. We believe your story. We don't hold you to be responsible. Or else they could say, keep the money. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever. But why tell them something which doesn't make any difference? He's telling them. If you're going to be convincing, you can't say something which they know is a lie. They're not stupid people. No, you can't, because you're not dealing with fools. What do you mean your money came to me? I got your money. They know that they never received their money. That's the exact same money. If a mistake was made, a mistake was made. And what are you saying? God gave you. What kind of thing is this? God gave you. It's like magic. You know, like when you were a kid, you put your tooth under the pillow and it's magic. What's he telling them over here? All of a sudden, it's your God has been good to you. It's the God of your father. It's a gift. It's a hidden treasure. They're not fools. They're not going to be reassured unless he's saying something which makes sense. So what does he mean about this matmon? And why is he saying, in addition, he says, your money came to me, I got your money. But they know that they didn't get the money. That they know for a fact, that the exact same, Sorel Costco, his wallet, his money pouch. That's the problem. Why he brings out Shimon at this point makes a lot of sense in the ensuing story, you will see. But it's not a problem. It's not a problem, because it doesn't say he released them yet. If Yosef's objective is merely to allay their fear, clearly that's at this point in time, to allay their fear that we're not ensnaring you, we're not laying a plot because of the money, so then fine, just accept the money. And they would have been very satisfied. They would have breathed a sigh of relief that they accept our explanation, and that's it, take the money. Or they could have said, you keep the money, I don't care about Michael the money. But this whole thing is out of place. Okay. Now, suddenly the situation takes an entire change, a totally different direction. Now he brings them into the house of Joseph. You see, beforehand they weren't, they realized they were being brought to his house. So they spoke to him outside the house. But now they come into the house. And he gives them water, and they wash their feet, and gives food for their donkeys that they were so worried about. Gives them food for the donkeys, and chafeh is interesting. And they prepared the gift. They used the time. Now they had some time. They used the time to prepare the gift until Yosef would arrive at noon, because they had heard that he was going to eat. Now they discovered that he was. See, they didn't know originally that they were being brought there for a feast, for a meal. They thought they were going to, when they discovered the house, they thought it was for a calamity. Just like Avurcha, it fits in with what we said last week. I was thinking about the idea of the gift. In my opinion, that was a brilliant stroke. The whole essence of that gift was that we're thoughtful people. It was a demonstration of respect and in the thoughtfulness of the gift. You see, by Echinu, they prepared it. It makes another point about that. What? The gift was, as we said last week, a small amount. It was something which was intended to disarm the man. It wasn't too blatant, it wasn't too big that it would appear like a bribe. So it couldn't have had a negative effect, couldn't have turned them off. On the other hand, it was endearing, it was disarming. Look how much they thought of me. It was a show of respect. That's why the Pasuk again mentions that they prepared it, because the presentation, the way it would be presented, would be in a very respectful, honorable kind of way. Now let's continue. Now Joseph comes to the house. Now you have the second part, the confrontation with Joseph. And the first thing they do is they bring the gift that's in their hand by Ishtachel Larson, and they bow down to him on the ground. Now that shows you, again, a further proof, the gift and the bowing forms one unit. The gift is not a separate thing. You see? If it was a bribe, it wouldn't have been given this way. But it's an act of respect. So they gave him the gift and they bowed. That's the greeting. That's the way we greet you. Okay. Then he greeted them. He asked them concerning their peace. That means he greeted. He gave them shalom. And he said, he asked them about your elderly father that you spoke about. Is he still alive? And they said, he's your servant. Our father is in a good state. He's still alive. So they bowed down again. They bowed down twice. I mean, the commentators speak about the reason of bowing twice. I'm not going to make a big issue out of it, but I don't think it's a problem. I think that the bowing, you find bowing in the Torah in two frameworks. The first bowing was respect for the man. The second one was an act of gratitude. Gratitude for the fact that he has spoken to them this way, and for the fact that he even inquired, but he's treating them with great respect now. In other words, one is I have no right to come before a king unless I bow. That's etiquette. The second one is like, thank you very much. The fact that you've shown us this kindness and you've asked about our father, they bowed down a second time. I'm not making an issue out of that. Then he lifts his eyes and he sees Binyamin, his brother, the son of his mother. And he says, is this the younger brother that you spoke about to me? Of course, it says, he knew it was Binyamin, but he has to go through the ruse. He has to pretend as though he doesn't know who he is. And he said, Elokim Yachtecha B'ni, may God show you mercy, my son. He says this to Binyamin. He gives him a special blessing, which he had not given to any of the other brothers. Yeah, why does he give him a special bracha? But then something happens again. See, what happens in Pasuk Lamed is not part of the plan. Then Yosef hurried, because his mercies were aroused. His mercies were drawn, were heated up, Rashi says, to his brother. And he sought to cry. This is something which is unplanned, obviously. Now he's totally overcome by emotion. And Rashi says that there was a discussion between them. He asked him if he has any sons, Binyamin. He had a very strong identification, the son of his mother, with Binyamin. And Binyamin tells him he has 10 sons, and they all have strange names. And every one of them is somehow reflective and reminiscent of what happened to his brother. So when he heard that, because apparently Binyamin looked up to his older brother, and the loss of his older brother was a tremendous blow, and he named every one of his sons as a different aspect of the fact that he was swallowed up amongst the nations. He learned Torah from my father. He was so pleasant to me. Chupim, one of his sons, Chupim, he wasn't at my chuppah. You know, all these things had a tremendous emotional impact upon Yosef. So Vayivakesh Lifkos. See, again, the perfected individual, I've made this point many times, is a person who lives in accordance with Chachma. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have emotion. Of course he has emotion. But he understands there's a place for the emotional life and there's a place for the intellect. He knows what situation to express the emotion and where it should be directed and when you don't express the emotion. So what happens? Why is the pasuk even mentioning this? The Torah is not going to tell us all the times that Yosef cried in his life. But there's an extremely important point over here. So what did he do? He left the room. He went into a different room and he cried there. So the Torah here is telling us about the fact that he cried. So then he washed his face and he left. That's why it's because it's Pasuk Lamed Aleph. The reason why it mentions about the crying is because of Lamed Aleph. Because it shows the greatness of Yosef, that he was completely overcome by emotion, but he overcame the emotion. That emotion could have destroyed the whole plan. Right then and there, it could have been destroyed. And the average person might have stopped, or even if he would, it would have distorted it. Any distortion in the plan, everything was worked out to perfection, could have knocked out the entire thing. And this, look at the word, Vayisapa, he exercised tremendous force. Because you see, it was a very powerful emotion. And he overcame the emotion, he put that emotion aside. Had he followed that emotion, it would have upset the entire plan. And he said, bring out the food. Okay. The emotion was an appropriate emotion. The perfection of the tzaddik is seen in his emotions as well.
Right, that's what.
Had he not had this emotion, yeah, it might have been construed as a defect. In other words,
right,
the okay, fine. So then we're clarifying.
Okay.
The objective of study of perfection is not to reach a state where you don't have emotions. And you just, right. I repeat this point because a lot of people have this misunderstanding, especially when it comes to the so-called philosophy of the yeshiva. Because we stress rationality and the importance of reason and chachma. So people have the impression that we're saying that you shouldn't have any emotion, you should be a robot. That's absurd. A human being is a creature of emotions, and he has to have emotional satisfaction. But the way to happiness is when the emotional satisfaction is in line with his chachma, is in line with his intelligence. So clearly, the very fact that he had this emotion shows his perfection. That he had this the sense of identification, the sense of compassion for what another person suffered. You see, he cried before with regard to the pain of the other brothers who had tried to harm him. Still, he felt tremendous compassion. And he recognized the need to have that cry. But the greatness at the same time that he's so-called indulging the emotion, he's doing it with intelligence. He did not allow it to distort the plan. So therefore, not in front of them. Goes to the other room. And then he waits. Then he gains strength. He also has the capacity to control, to exercise control over his emotions. That's a very big element. Not everybody has. Because a lot of times people have powerful emotions, and then they do stupid things, and they say, what can I do? I was just overcome by the emotion. Well, then the question is, well, why didn't you overcome? That means you had failed to reach a point where you were capable of controlling your emotions. That's a very important element in perfection. The capacity to control it. Nothing wrong with having it. He didn't deny it either. There was no reason to denial would be wrong. No, you're right. Okay, for the meal. So, what did he do? There were three different groups at the meal, it seems. They placed him separately and them separately. And the Egyptians that ate with him were separate, because the Egyptians wouldn't eat with the Jews. They wouldn't eat bread with them, because that was an abomination to them. And the Persians say, I'm not going to go into that. The Persians basically say, because of the fact that they ate the meat of sheep and they worshipped the sheep and so forth. Okay, so you have three separate groups over here. It's not clear. I'm not going to get out into that issue. The Pasuk on Beis you can analyze further. It's not clear what it says that the Mitzrim wouldn't eat with the Jews. Is that a reference to they were separate from the brothers, but they ate with Yosef? Some want to say, but of course they ate with Yosef, because Yosef was the leader of the land. He was special. So whether I'm not really that concerned at this point. That's a separate issue. Anyways, they sat before him. The Bechor. Now, here, this is interesting, because he arranged them in accordance with their ages. The older one sat at the head, and the younger one down the line. In other words, they were arranged chronological order according to their ages. And then it says, and the men, this is a hard one to understand, and they sort of wondered. They looked at each other in wonderment. They put them in a state, they were wondering, like, what's going on over here? What were they wondering about? What's he trying to convey?
How did he know the order?
So some want to say, I have a tough time with this.
I have one of the brothers, the whole time.
Yeah. I know. So Rashi says that he did it with the goblet, that he showed that he was able to divine, and he called out Reuven, Shimon, and therefore they were surprised. That how did he know? That's a little bit difficult to accept that shot. I don't know why he would want to do it, but also, why would it surprise them that he knew the ages when he had Shimon there the entire time?
Why don't you just think that surprised them at all?
Then he took gifts of food, I guess delicacies, from in front of him. In other words, it would seem that the main foods were placed before Yosef, and they would take from him and give to the rest of them. And here is very interesting. He increased the gift of Binyamin. The gift of Binyamin was five times greater than their gift. That's strange. That, of course, requires an explanation. Well, what was the purpose of that? What was the purpose of this whole thing? The whole seating arrangement, seating them in order, and so forth, and they were wondering, and then he gives out gifts. And then he increases the gift of Binyamin. What's the point of all this?
Wasn't Benjamin at the head of the table?
Rashi says, okay, there's no problem. Rashi mentions that he sat them chronologically, but also he grouped them in accordance with who their mothers were. And once he came to Binyamin, he said, this one doesn't have a mother, and I don't have a mother. He's just next to me. So that fits in with the general. He did show favoritism to Binyamin, clearly. So if you want to learn like that, Rashi, it's not that crucial to me. It fits in with the general idea. So that particular fact of where he sat is not that important to me. It's not put down openly in the pasuk. So fine. Before we go any further, we have to understand, in a general sense, there's one big question that encompasses all the specific questions until now. What's the big question? What's the purpose of this whole thing? What is the purpose of this whole thing? It seems that phase two, the return, Joseph's major objective was to set up a situation in which it would appear that Binyamin had stolen the goblet. That's the whole thing. So in other words, the objective was to have them come back, resolve the misunderstanding, whatever, send them on their way, and trap Binyamin to put the goblet, the cup, or whatever. It didn't have to be the cup. You can't tell me that this whole party was arranged so that they should be in the house so that he accused them of stealing the cup. He could have placed a different object. If he wanted to make it appear that Binyamin was a thief, which is obviously, that's the ultimate goal of everything that's going on over here, it didn't have to be a cup. I don't think that's... And then in order to be a cup, he had to bring them to the house. And in order to do that, he had to have a party. I mean, the whole thing is difficult to understand. So basically, up until this point, I would say, my first question is, why did he act in such a way to arouse their fears? In other words, he seems to be going from one extreme to the other when they return. First, he acts in such a way to bring them into a state of fear. Because it's not by accident that they were afraid when they came to the house. On the other hand, he's going to the other extreme to make them feel happy, to put them at ease, and so forth. So I don't know what the whole purpose of all this is in general, what the purpose is. But even within the framework, he seems to be going kind of in contradictory directions. First, he makes them fearful. This is the worst thing. They're going to take us as slaves and our donkeys. And then they give the explanation. And the second question was the answer of his assistant. This thing about I've received your money and this is a gift from God. Well, we don't even understand what that means. And then the next thing we want to understand is, what was the purpose of the party? There's no need at this point in time. The misunderstanding is cleared up that they have to have a party with him, and he treats them with such tremendous regard to the extent that it says Vayishtu Vayishkiru Imo. I didn't even read that yet. In the end of Lamed Daled, it says, after he gave out gifts to each of the brothers and he increased the gift of Binyamin, then it says they drank Vayishkiru Imo. That literally means shikar. Shikar is drunk. I don't think it means that they actually got drunk in the sense that they lost control. It means that they drank excessively. Drank a great deal, like at a party. Yeah, I know. The Mepharshim bring it down.
No,
Rashi says that they hadn't gotten drunk. They hadn't drunk. Joseph hadn't. Rashi mentions from the time they had told Joseph they hadn't drunk any wine. And now they did. Could be. I mean, you can answer it simply and say that this situation required it. Until now, there was no reason to drink, and but now they had no choice. They didn't want to offend him. When you're in that situation and you're facing a danger, you don't want to offend the man. And if he offers you a drink, you don't turn it down. So let's just leave it at that. Let's go through it quickly. So now he instructs his assistant to fill up their sacks with food, as much as they can bear. And again, and place the money in each man's sack. And my cup, my silver cup, place in the sack of the youngest one, and in addition to his money. And he did in accordance with the words of Joseph. Okay. So it's not clear why he returns the money. The goblet, I understand. Because the goblet is going to be the basis of the accusation against Binyamin. But why does he return the money again? That doesn't... They're never accused. You'll soon see. They're never accused of stealing the money. Anyways, come morning, the light of day, the next day, and the men were sent out, they and their donkeys. They left the city, didn't go far. Then Yosef commanded his assistant to go and run after them. And when you catch them, say to them, why did you pay back evil for good? Is this not that which my master drinks from, and he also divines with it? You have acted in an evil fashion. That's what he instructs them to say. So he caught them, and he spoke to them these words. So now they find themselves being confronted with an accusation. So they answered him. They said, "Why does my master talk this way? Chalila lavada, chas, you know the expression, heaven forbid, chas v'shalom, how could you say a thing like this? How could we do a thing like this? How could you accuse us of something like this?" And then they used the Kal V'chomer. We were just working on Kal V'chomer. They respond with amazement. How can you say? Then they use the Kal V'chomer. Behold, the money that we found in our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. So how can we steal from the house of our master silver or gold? Like the Gemara, there's more than 10 Kal V'chomers in the Torah. Kal V'chomer, that money which we found, we brought back to you. So how can you accuse us of being, why would we steal? How can you accuse us of thievery? Whoever, now this, you tell me what's difficult about this. Whoever amongst your servants the money is found on shall be killed. What you say, the one upon whom the money is found will be a slave to me, and you'll be free. They offered more. They said to him, "You should kill, and we'll all be slaves." Now, what's difficult about Malki? Malki had the question. The Lord, what you're all saying is correct. True. Why do you have to offer? Don't offer yourself. Because you'll say, well, "What's the difference whether I offer or don't offer?" It's not true. Because sometimes you're in a situation where you may be accused and you may be subject to a punishment, and if you would have kept quiet, maybe they would have given you a lighter punishment. But if you make a statement, you're so convinced that you're innocent and you make an offer, well, if I'm guilty, you can put me in jail for 10 years, and really it's the kind of thing you only get 3 years, so they may put you in jail for 10 years, and then you can't argue. Well, they'll say, look, you said yourself, so why, there's nothing to be gained, don't weaken your case. But why did they make a statement like this? Why did they say a thing like this?
They were so sure.
They knew them. They each one knew the nature of their brothers. That they weren't thieves. They weren't just talking out of the top of their heads.
But they didn't fill their sense.
They were so convinced. What's difficult is the question that Mary had asked. That's what struck me like a lightning bolt the last time, a few weeks ago, when I was reading this.
They would have stopped them the first
time. They were so convinced, of course, that tzaddikim, and insofar as robbing is concerned, they had total confidence that that one brother. And that's why they could say, if that was the only factor, they could say, take anybody who stole, you can kill him. They'd have no fear of making such a statement, because they were completely convinced that they're all tzaddikim, and they would never steal anything from anybody. Yeah, but one second, but you already know that the money was returned the first time. So that's not the only factor, and that's what you were worried about. This was the major concern all along, and when you found the money, you were terribly frightened. So why shouldn't you be concerned that maybe this is in place there and it's part of a plot? What happened to that fear? That's the question. That's a very powerful question, and they're acting as though the only thing we have to be concerned about over here is any one of our brothers a thief. So as far as that's concerned, we're totally convinced that there's no thief here. We're so convinced that kill him and take the rest of us as slaves. That's very nice, but there's another thing that could be considered. Maybe somebody is plotting against you. How can you forget something like that? This already happened to you the first time. Even if it never happened to you, you should be concerned. But in light of what they had gone through, that they'd been already subjected to that type of thing, how could they have forgotten that? How could they just make a statement? That, I thought, was a very powerful question. The rest, as they say, is history. Right? Unfortunately, they all hurry now. You see, they hurried down. They were so convinced that this was a mistake, that there's nothing to be afraid of. They hurried, and each person unloaded his sack to the ground, and each person opened the sack, and they began to search. They started with the older one, and they completed it with the younger one, and they found the cup in the sack of Binyamin. And they tore their garments. Mourning, that's it. This is the worst possible thing. the worst tragedy. Everything had been looking so nicely. They were on their way home with Binyamin, with food, with the money. Everything was perfect, and now this is the worst possible thing. It's unbelievable drama over here, just on the level of drama. I mean, interestingly enough, what about the money? There's no accusation about the money, no mention about the money. That's strange. I'll answer that. So, what? Each person wearily gets back upon his donkey, and they return to the city. Then Yehuda and the brothers. See, again, Yehuda is emerging into a position of leadership. The responsibility falls upon Yehuda. They came to the house of Yosef, and he was still there, of course, he knew. And they fell before him on the ground. And then Yosef says to him, "What is this that you've done? Did you not know that a man like me would divine, that I'd figure this out, I would divine it, that you had stolen it?" And Yehuda says, "What shall we say to my master?" Again, extra words, "Manadaber, what can we say, what can we explain? Manadstadak, how can we justify ourselves? God has found the sin of your servants. Behold, we are slaves to my master, also us, also the one upon whom the cup was found." We're all guilty over here. We're all slaves. And he, and Joseph said, "Chalilali." They had said the same word, "Chalila." What do you mean? I'm a man of justice. Chas v'shalom. To do such a thing like this, I wouldn't do that. The man upon whom the cup was found, he shall be unto me as a slave. He'll be punished. And you go up in peace to your father. I have no problem with you. Why should I punish you? I don't believe in collective punishment. But what is difficult about Tes Zayin? Why is he admitting guilt? Why is he admitting he's guilty? That's not good. It's true the situation is very, very bad, but the truth is that they didn't do anything wrong. So why admit guilt? There's a misunderstanding over here, whatever, but he's saying God. Not only is he admitting guilt, but he's saying God has found the sin. God has found the sin of your servant. What does he mean by that? So to plead guilty? Now once you plead guilty, again you're going to make it easier for the man to punish. Okay. I think the key to understanding what Yosef was doing here, to begin with, lies in the response of the brothers. The response of the brothers, as we said, is very strange. Because they had absolute confidence that it was impossible that any one of them had stolen the goblet. But somehow or other, it didn't even occur to them that they could be the victims of a plot, of a frame-up. And that's very difficult in light of their past experience. Okay? Now, to understand that, we have to understand the strategy of Yosef. Everything that Yosef did from the time of their return was based upon, had two objectives in terms of the overall plot, in terms of his overall mission of bringing them back to tshuva, of course. See, of course he was trying to create a situation in which Binyamin would be subjected to the accusation, and the test would be to see how the brothers would react. Now, in order to proceed for the time being, he had to deal with the issue of the return money. That had to be explained. He knew he had set that up in the first place. He knew that was the fear that they had. Even in returning, they were returning into a situation which could possibly be a calamity because of the money. They didn't know what to make of the money. Now, his objective was not just to eliminate the fear. His objective was more than that. He could have, if he wanted to, just resolve the issue in a simple way. He wouldn't have brought them to the house. He could have discussed it with them. He could have brought it up himself. He could have said, "We noticed some money." Then they could have explained. He could have done it many ways. He could have waited for them to bring it up. There are many ways he could have dealt with the issue, and they would have accepted the explanation. But clearly that was not his intention. What was his intention? What was the purpose of bringing them to the house? He brings them to the house, and this increases their fears. It makes them extremely frightened. And then the explanation of the assistant. What was the point of it? See, basically his objective was not just to straighten out the misunderstanding, but to show them that their entire outlook on the situation was completely wrong. And that in fact it was entirely different. And there's a reason for that. I'll explain. See, they were afraid. They had a fear. Now, of course, when Yaakov discovered the money, they couldn't understand what the purpose is. It looks like a frame-up. But that was one scenario. The worst-case scenario is that this is all part of a frame-up. But there was another possibility of Ulai Mishkehu. Mistakes can be made. It can be a mistake. Now, Yosef, when they came back, Yosef's objective was to show them that their worst fears were totally unfounded. There was no reason. And in fact, in point of fact, this entire thing was a mistake. But more than that, you'll see that when they discover Yosef acting this way, it's going to produce an important change in their entire outlook. He is aiming to produce a situation not just where they cease to be afraid of Yosef, but where they have tremendous, total confidence in Yosef to the extent that they would never suspect him of doing anything underhanded again. And Yosef used a very interesting psychological ploy. Rabbi Chait explained this point years ago. It's not my own. I don't want, you know. A lot of the share in general, I based myself on a lot of points that Rabbi Chait made. Then I've made my own connections or expansions. I don't want it. It's like hard. So it's cumbersome to always stop and say. But I'm just making, in this particular point, is a very important psychological point. You have to understand the way the psyche operates. To do this, in order to put them in a situation where they'd have no fear whatsoever, and they'd never be suspicious of him, he first has to heighten their fears. He's playing with their mind. He heightens their fears. He brings them to have no idea. They think the worst. That's what I think it means. This person is, he's out to frame us. Liz Golel, Liz Nafel, and to take our slaves, and even to take our donkeys. We're dealing with the worst type of a cruel dictator. He'll just take anything and everything. That's the first, that's how they're looking at the man. He deliberately is setting up a situation. That's why I think it means Yes Hamoreinu. Not that they're worried about the donkeys. That's the kind of person he is. He's just a total arbitrary tyrant, the dictator. He's just going to wipe away strangers. We have no defense. He's going to wipe us out. Even take our donkeys. That's the kind of person he is. He'll take everything we've got. It's not because they're afraid of losing the donkeys. It's a reflection of that is exactly what he wanted the brothers to think, that he was that kind of a person. And he acts in two different frameworks. He gives them enough room to look at it that way. So then they're frightened, and they go to the assistant. Now the assistant begins to employ the other interpretation. See, the brothers, they don't know what the truth is yet, and they have two scenarios. What's the answer? What did he say? Now I'll try and explain the answer. He says, "Don't shalom lachem, al tirah. God gave you a gift. It's a treasure. Your money came to me. What kind of a thing is this?" He said, "It doesn't make sense. They know that that's not true." The answer is, this is my interpretation. He didn't mean it literally. He explained, I think it would make sense in modern big business, if you're doing big business. If you're doing, let's say you bought something from this huge, huge company that does millions and millions of dollars of business, and you discover a mistake, you know, like $10, you got back $10 more, something like that. So you're going to go down to the company with the $10 and tell them to say, they're going to say, look, that's the policy. I mean, we're going to have to go back into our records. We're going to have to check it out. And it's not worth it to keep the $10. I mean, it's very often a company will have a policy like that. It doesn't make any sense. We can't go checking through all the records if we discover a mistake on the spot, so then we deal with it. What he was saying is like this. We're dealing with mega dollars, multi-billion dollars. People from all over the world are coming. Of course there's going to be mistakes. So we have to, we worked out some kind of thing. We have an accounting system. Kasachan Boilai means, in terms of your records, we don't have any record of a problem. No, this was not recorded. So we have to, whenever we have a policy like that, we know that sometimes we're gonna gain, sometimes we'll win, sometimes you'll win. So Kasachan Boilai means, in terms of the records, there's no record of any missing money. Your records are clean. That's what he means, your money has come to me. So therefore, regarded as a treasure, you lucked out. So how are we good people? In such a case, we're not greedy. And in that type of a situation, our policy is you keep the money because we're not going to go back and we have to deal with the records, whatever it is. Sometimes we win, sometimes you win. So then be thankful. You're the lucky one. Your God gave you a gift. That's the matmon. That's the answer that he gave. That made perfect sense. That's what they were hoping for. This whole thing was just a big misunderstanding. What were we so worried about the whole time? Just a big misunderstanding. You're God. You should be saying, in other words, you're lucky. It's a sense of saying, oh, he didn't use the word luck. So maybe you were deserving. Because that these things can happen if you find money somewhere in the street. So maybe it's because your God was good to you. That's what he's saying. Treat it that way. Well, whatever you are. Well, he says, you're God. You're God. Yeah, you're a good person. You're a religious person. So your God wants to reward you. In other words, as far as I'm concerned, I got the money. I don't have any problem. Now, that's the beginning of the so-called disinformation. Now the brothers are beginning to realize that all their fears were not warranted. Now, the next thing is Yosef. That's the beginning of the so-called disinformation. Now the brothers are beginning to realize that all their fears were not warranted. Now, the next thing is Yosef. They deal with Yosef. What's the objective of everything that Yosef does? Why did Yosef decide to have this meal with them? Two things about the meal. There are two things about the meal. One is to show what? One is to show favor to the young. True. To make them relax, show what a decent person he is. A different side. In other words, they didn't really know the nature of this person, Yosef. Is he a cruel individual who's just going to wipe us out? Or like he said, I fear the Lord. In other words, he's very tough. He's very concerned about his country. But once everything has been solved, he's a very good person. So the meal is his attempt to make it up to them.
Especially after being obsessed with the fact that he's a megalomaniac and then getting by with this matmon, now to see a very gratuitous, gracious person of him,
That's the point.
That they had about megalomaniac and bigger
things. Now, their whole idea about Yosef has been transformed. Instead of Yosef being a cruel person and a vicious person, it turns out he's a decent individual and a gracious person, and he wants to make it up to us. This is compensation. He's making it up to them. He's going to, if you people were subjected to this, I had to do it, I had no choice. But now that the matter has been resolved, I want to make it up to you. So he shows them respect. How are you? How's your family? This younger brother. Then he sets up a beautiful meal. And they wonder. See, I interpret they wonder. Why did he set them up in accordance with what's going on over here? It's like they're going through a certain change. That, to me, is a sign of respect. He's showing respect. Because if it's just a gathering, so who cares how you... No, the fact that we're seated, the eldest one and the next one, that's a sign of dignity, that's a sign of respect. Now the point, how this operates is as follows. Let me just finish. Let me just get the point out, then we'll take questions. This is the point that Rabbi Chaik made years ago. I remember him saying it in the shiur. I didn't remember what the context was, whether it was attempting to answer this question or not. And It came to mind when I was dealing with this problem as to why the brothers were so confident later on. I remembered it vaguely. Then I met with them and I discussed it again. We went over the point again. So. And it makes perfect sense. See, when you're suspicious about a person, sometimes you find yourself in a situation where you're suspicious about a person, but you're not sure. You'll have that all kinds of situations. Sometimes you have people working at the house or whatever, the housekeeping, things are missing. You're not sure. And you have certain suspicions. And you keep an eye. There's always a certain amount of guilt. You know, you feel bad about the fact that you suspect them. Now let's say a situation like this. This is not just suspecting a person of a small thing, but you are suspecting this person of a terrible, terrible thing. And then it turns out that not only were they unfounded, but you were completely 100% wrong. This person's a great individual, a great child, a wonderful person. Then you're going to go to the other, you're going to have tremendous amounts of guilt about suspecting that person again. The idea, the thought that this person, you see, you're going to feel very guilty about the fact that you ever suspected him. And in any kind of a situation, let's say that happened with someone, in any kind of relationship, friend, one of your friends who was suspicious they weren't loyal to you, or a boyfriend, or a spouse, whatever it may be. And you unfairly suspected them, then it turns out that it's completely false. And now some new things pop up. You're going to be very hesitant about the making an issue of it. You're going to feel very guilty about it, and that's ridiculous. You know, you did it once before, and this person decided you're going to have a tremendous amount of reluctance. Now I wanted to add, in addition, see, I'm expanding on these points. I'm not taking the points exactly the way I'm expanding upon them. Teach me also that in general, see, a person is operating with a certain sense of how reality ought to be. You have a certain sense of how the world functions. Then things happen in a strange kind of a way. And, you know, you have a certain interpretation. You may panic. Then it turns out that all this was crazy, it was fears and so forth. Again, if something comes up, you can have a reluctance. You're not gonna, it's like you call the police. You hear some noise, you're home alone. So you hear a few noises, so you get scared. You call the police one time. And they show you, it's just a loose shutter. What are you getting? Then it happens a second time. A third time. Then after that, you're convinced that there's no... Then let's say after the police leave the third time, they hear a totally different kind of a noise. You're going to be very reluctant to call on me. I mean, you know, you're going to be very reluctant because your attitude is, this is your own fears, your own craziness, and you should trust your mind. There's nothing wrong. This is basically what took place over here. That's clear from... that's why Vayishtu Vayishkarim means friendship. They drank with him Vayishikar. They'd reached the point where they were so relaxed, they were so unguarded, that he's a tremendous friend. They left with a feeling, and all of our fears were created. Once, see, when you have that feeling that you have this tremendous fear, and all of our fears are unwarranted, now you have a tendency to go to the other extreme. Now you feel that sense of total confidence in the situation. Nothing could possibly be bad over here. That's what Yosef was playing upon. That's what Yosef was playing upon. The other thing, that was the setup. He set it up so beautifully, so that when this man came and said that one of the brothers has stolen the cup, so as far as they were concerned, it didn't occur to them that Yosef could have done this to them. Therefore, the only possible explanation would be that one of the brothers was a thief. That they knew was an impossibility. That's what they were prepared to say. Whoever it is, you can kill him. We know for sure it's an impossibility, because Yosef would never do this, and none of our brothers would steal. The second objective was Binyamin. And you see, he has special treatment from Binyamin. First of all, Elokim Yachtecha Bini. You see, he treats him differently. He has a special blessing for him, a special bracha. May God show you mercy, my son. And then, in the seating, according to Rashi, if you want to say that he sat next to Yosef, that's a show of favoritism. But what the most blatant action is the fact that he gives them all gifts, and then he increases the gift of the young. What was the purpose of that? Why did he do that? Yes. The Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva. See, all this is part of Tshuva. Now, the brothers had not yet completed their Tshuva with regard to the sin against Yosef. And the first element of Tshuva is recognition of the sin. That they had achieved. Aval Hashem Manachem Alachinim. We are guilty concerning our brothers. They had admitted their guilt. Yes, but there's regret. And then there's the, what we call, acceptance upon yourself for the future. Change for the future. So the brothers had not completed it yet. Now the Rambam says, he talks about Tshuva Gemura. He talks about ordinary tshuva and what's called tshuva gemura means complete tshuva, ultimate tshuva. There's two different levels of tshuva. Now the case he gives it of ultimate tshuva is where a person has sinned and they've done tshuva, but they're in the situation, the exact same situation in which they did the original chet for the first time. He uses an illustration. Let's say a man sinned with a woman. It was a romantic type of thing. And then after a time, he's back in the same situation with her. He even mentions even in the same place. Apparently the place has a role to play. It evokes certain passion. He's back in the same place, and he's in the same state of emotion. He has the same love, the same desire, and the same opportunity in the same situation, and he refrains from doing it because of tshuva. So I think it's a similar thing over here. In order to effectuate the tshuva, he has to recreate the situation. Now this is another point that, this is not my point, the point that you're making was made by Rabbi Chait, that he's playing to their unconscious. Unconsciously he's recreating the situation. Because him by sitting alone as the leader is the father figure. Really the ultimate, the envy was because that Yosef had received the favoritism of Jacob, of Yaakov. But Yaakov is the father figure. So now he's duplicating the same situation all over again, except this time you don't need to have the exact same individual. It's the one who they would all look up to as being the father figure, who was Yosef. Yosef sat alone. He's the leader. He's at the head. And in that context, he lines them all up as they were brothers. That's why he sets them up, the older one. In other words, he recreates the situation of brotherhood. That's why he lines them up that way. He's recreating that whole family situation, and perhaps that's why they're wondering, what's this about? They're beginning to notice something. The wonderment means they're noticing that something is happening over here. It's making an impact upon them. The pasuk doesn't record what they're wondering about, but they're wondering about the whole situation. In that situation, he gives them, and he singles out Binyamin. So that's recreating in the unconscious that same emotion of favoritism, of rivalry, of envy. Now can they overcome it? That apparently is essential. It's essential that when the time will come where Benjamin will be accused, and it'll be up to the brothers now to decide whether we're going to fight them or abandon them, it's got to be in a situation where the emotion of envy has been brought to the forefront in order for it to be a tshuva gemura. Okay, I'll pause for a second. Quick. Yosef, as they had witnessed him, was a brilliant individual. They saw his tremendous wisdom. They saw his brilliance. They saw his power. There were enough factors over there so that everybody would regard him as being a father figure, and it would clearly evoke the emotion. It doesn't have to be identical on the conscious level. You see? That would be an impossibility. But Yosef sought to recreate the situation to the greatest degree that was possible. See? With regard to the money, I believe it's the Ramban. The return of the second money was done with their knowledge. Yes. The return of their money was done with their knowledge. That is part of the camouflage. To show what a wonderful person he is. Compensation. He's not taking money this time. You've suffered enough. That makes perfect sense. Because if the money, the second return money, was for an accusation, it doesn't come up later on. It's never brought, you never see any mention of that money. That's totally ignored. They unpacked. So if he intended to use that against them, that wouldn't make any sense anyway, because the intention was to say, you're all innocent. There's only one person that's guilty, and that's Benjamin. So why would they, and it doesn't say they saw the mummy and they became frightened. So I think it makes perfect sense to go along with the Ramban that they were there and they saw. The return of the money was done with their knowledge. That again increased their sense of gratitude. Someone that
confidence.
Confident gratitude, a man that's been such a benefactor. In fact, that was his whole, what did he say she accused him of? Not stealing. But ingratitude. Lama shilam temra tapatamba. That's what he said you should tell them. What kind of people are you? How can you repay my goodness, my gratitude? Ah, that's the accusation. That shows that everything that he had been doing all along was to demonstrate his kindness, his beneficence. He's a wonderful person. Yeah, the fact that I was tough with you, that's I'm a rational person. I'm just, I'm rational, but once you've convinced me that everything's okay, then my good side comes out. How can you repay evil with goodness? And that explains the return of the money. Now, there's only one thing that's left, and that is, we asked, when they, as soon as they saw the goblet, we explained why they had total confidence now. Because Yosef had brought about a complete change in their attitude, their outlook. Tremendous, you see again the tremendous brilliance, the psychological understanding that's reflected here. Well, what can you do? They rent their garments. This is it. There's nothing more. What can we say? What can we do? God has found. What does it mean? They weren't admitting guilt.
It's reality. Sometimes
they weren't admitting guilt. They weren't doing tshuva.
I think this is a bad thing that happened to me. There's nothing that I could do about it. In other words, sometimes you put into a situation where you just, I mean, you have that flat tire and you're not going to make it. And that's what am I going to do about it? It happens. So yeah, I can't fight it. You can't fight reality.
Yeah. In other words, there's no excuse that can be given. Why? Why is there no excuse? There's no explanation. Why is there no explanation? Because this is all a frame-up. Our worst fear of it. It's exactly what we've heard all along. This is a frame-up. There's nothing, I mean, now it's clear to us that that whole thing was a hoax. But the fear we had originally, when we first discovered, you see, there are always two possible scenarios. The fear that we had originally, when we discovered the return money, he said they were extremely afraid. What has God done to us is that if this is a plot to destroy us, then there's no defense. Now with the return of the goblet, that's clear. Whatever he's been doing has been a setup for this moment. That's why they said they fell upon his mercy. It paves the way. Yehuda is the one that says it. In order to understand why he says this, I'm telling you what he says. God has found the sin is not saying we stole. It means that we understand that there's something bigger that's happening over here. And somehow or other it fell, God, why did it fall upon us? You're doing this because of certain necessity that you have with your, you know, with your situation, with being the ruler of Egypt. So I don't know what that is. And there's nothing we can do to change that. I'm not going to pass judgment on whether it was right for them to say, to make the statement, or whether they shouldn't have said anything at all. I'm not passing judgment on them. That wasn't the question. The question of Mary was that, logically, it didn't make any sense that they should have been suspicious of a plot, and I'm saying, no, given everything that had happened to them, put yourself in that situation, where you had your worst fears, and you had construed a certain scenario, and then you find out that it was totally false. And all along, you know, sometimes they want to set up a secret surprise birthday party. But they do certain things to mislead you. And you think that people are doing negative things. You know, why is your husband going out late at night? And this, why is he talking to that woman? And this, and you build up this whole scenario. And then it turns out that it was all for you. And he was doing it to set up a party. Then you're going to go to the other extreme and feel any kind of guilt whatsoever. You'll never say a bad thing about this person, at least for the next 3 days. You see, that's the type of now, we're all human. You can't defend yourself against that. I'm a machine. It's not going to happen. I'm such a rational person that'll always be there. It's not. They're human beings. It's going to happen. If that should happen, like a few weeks have gone by and you got these teeth, I heard him on talking on the telephone to a girl talking about a gift. It sounds like he's having a relationship with another woman, and then it turns out afterwards that all this was being done for your benefit. He's a great guy. So how are you going to feel? You're not going to accuse him so quickly. Now, that's what happened over here. Now, should they have not said anything at all? I'm not asking that question. They're human beings. That's the natural response. The natural response is, we're totally innocent. Chalila, how can you say anything like this? And, of course, what remains, Yehuda said this, it made sense. You will see, the last part of this series is resolution. And that, of course, is Vayigash. And we'll try and do that next week. What exactly did Yehuda say? What was the strategy of Yehuda? Because in the next parsha, he approached Vayigash Yehuda. Now Yehuda steps to the fore, and he makes a very impassioned plea. And apparently this is the last element. Once Yosef hears this, then he decides to end the entire thing, and now it's time for reconciliation. So what was the strategy of Yehuda? Now, in this opening statement, Yehuda is preparing. He's laying the groundwork for his appeal. This was said with chokmah. This was said with wisdom. God has found the sin of your servants. In other words, he's not saying we stole. He's not saying we stole the goblin. He's not saying we never stole the goblin. In my opinion, he's saying we've fallen into a trap. There's nothing we can say. There's no justification. There's no way I can get out of this. So he's going to try something else. Because of the Eschol already, the way I understand it, and also our donkeys, is like depicting what base kind of people, like the Nazis. It's not just ideological, they want to wipe out the Jews for ideological reasons. They took everything from them. The hair from them, the gold cavities, the filling, everything. Like base, any little penny they could take. That's what kind of people they are. You see, that's what we've fallen into. That's an expression of what this man is about. Now that's important. That's good. He wants them to think that, because once they find out how wrong they've been, they're going to go to the other extreme. Three, in setting up the situation in which he's going to favor Binyamin, that's part of his objective, he does show great respect for them as a family, because he wants to create that family feeling.
Not the family.
That's the point.
Israel.
I'm sorry?
But not as family, as Kol Israel, the people like, whenever Abraham got in trouble.
Okay, that's true too.
But the idea is their idea. Yeah.
It doesn't. Okay, I mean, you, yeah. The Yellow State has already said, I have to get a Lord. I said, well, kill him the other. I fear the Lord, I'm special. See, Yosef has retained a certain mysterious kind of an aura in their life. They don't know Yosef. Mm-hmm. He's very brilliant about that. Now he's maneuvering the situation.
Right.
I mean, we don't ascribe super natural powers to any individual. But this is unbelievable. I mean, it's frightening how brilliant he emerges. His knowledge of people and his ability to maneuver situations and bring about results is almost, it's not superhuman. We're not attributing superhuman powers. But this is about as close as it gets. It's almost frightening. I wouldn't want to be up against someone like that. I'd want, you know, someone like that on our side. Well, of course, Yosef is on our side.